Okay, so I'm Lynn, and I'm really very excited to be here. I met Aliza, comes to Israel, you know, like every year, and she stops by our school. And I have her talk, and she said, when you come, maybe you'll speak at this WIC conference. So it's really very exciting to be here. I envy you in the sense that you're really out there in the front lines. You're really the ones who are helping the people get to Israel. I'm just there, you know, the receiving end, once you've done all the hard work. So we get them, and we work with all sorts of different students at Medrash Rachel. I've, you know, been in this business for like a long time, 25 years or so, and we see a lot of different issues. I do have to say that I think it's changed over time. As time goes on and the society changes a certain way, so too the students change a certain way. So what I'm going to do really is kind of like talk to you about the population that I work with, which are, if you're working with like college-age kids or older, let's say anywhere from 21 to 35, you know what I mean? Then you'll relate to what I'm saying. But even so, even if you're working with families, you're going to hear, because a lot of the issues that the students have is because it's coming from the families. You know what I mean? Nothing happens in a vacuum. That's for sure. So before I begin the ideas about mental health, so I wanted to just give you a little bit of a Dvar Torah, not on the paper that you have, that'll be for the end. But you know, there's a pasuk when they're talking about the plague of darkness, the plague of Choshech, that reads, what was this plague? It reads, Lo rau ish et achav, velo kamu ish mitachtav. That's how the plague of Choshech is described. No man could see his brother, nor could anyone rise from their place. That's what the plague of Choshech was, and Rashi actually explains that the darkness was not just visual, it was also palpable. So somehow what that means, it had substance. So if you were sitting, you literally felt like you were stuck to your seat, like something was pushing you down, that you couldn't... Hello. That you couldn't get up. And if you were standing, also, you couldn't sit down, you were stuck. So this pasuk can also be understood as a moral lesson. So oftentimes, even when people are very much in need of help, there's nobody to help. There's no one paying attention. I read in a book by Rabbi Pelkowitz, which is a very nice book called Table Talk. He has some very good ideas in there. That perhaps the Torah is alluding to something when they say that no man could see his brother, therefore no one could rise from his place. Lo ro, below kamu. Understand? So one has to be able to observe, and you have to see what's happening around you if you're going to do anything at all. And you can be sure that if there is lo ro, there will definitely be lo kamu. They will not get up. And, of course, what it says about Bnei Yisrael in reference to this plague, ulechol Bnei Yisrael haya or b'moshpotehem, but for the children of Israel, there was light in their dwellings. So the dwellings of the Jewish people are certainly meant to be filled with Torah and or and light, the light of Torah and chesed and caring, where people see. What makes chesed so unique is that's where you see the need of somebody. You can't do chesed if you don't see, if you don't observe what needs to be done. Because otherwise, what would chesed be, right? So that's the opposite. And that for that reason, there was light in Am Yisrael. We all work in the field, I think, where we have to be extremely observant. So that's the first thing I want to say to this crowd, is that you have to see beyond the superficial. And I think there is a tendency that when somebody presents themselves to you, because we're very honest people, we accept them for what they are. I see you in front of me, and I think, oh, that's what you are, you know what I mean? And sometimes I don't realize that's not true. That's partially true. But there's really a lot of other stuff going on in this person's life and who they... Is that okay?
Yeah, everything you need here?
No, we're okay. So our goal, first and foremost, is to help people to become very integrated people, to be very connected and very whole in the firm world. And what we have to do is make sure that the inside of the person and the outside of the person are integrated. So when we talk about what mental health is, I think that's a very key idea. There's an integration idea that I can't just, you know, look a certain way and sound a certain way if I'm not really that way. You know, and even when you're from, and you're from birth, let's say, and you want to try to be a good person, you want to try to be a, so sometimes you try to do the right thing and you really go above what, who are your feelings. So sometimes that's good, but sometimes if it's not really who you are, and you're not really ready for a certain step in Bein Adam L'Chavero or certain other areas, and you go there, you're not integrating it with who you are. It's going to play out in an unhealthy way, in some way. You know what I mean? So that's something that we have to watch out for. I'd like to look at a few major areas that I have seen where mental health issues are prominent. So you have to ask yourself, let's say you're working with like this age, college age kids, 21 to 28, something like that. You have to ask them, what are most people like this looking for when they go away? What are they looking for? They're looking for identity. They're looking for friends. They're looking to have a good time, that's for sure. And maybe, they want to figure out what they're supposed to do in life. Maybe they're looking for a deeper sort of meaning. Now, let's say this kid chooses to interact with you. You're a Kiruv person. Comes to your house for Shabbos or on campus or wherever it is. You have to ask yourself, why? Why are they coming to you? So I'm going to throw that question out. You see people, right? And they come to you. Did you ever ask yourself, why? Why are they coming to you? For food. Good. That's a very good answer. That's often very true. We hear that all the time. Chabad knows about that, right? Yeah. Do you know how much great homemade challah does? Right?
Challah,
right? People name it. So that is definitely a reason. Why else do you think they come? Why do they want to interact with you?
It's fun.
So that's what she said. The food, the fun. Okay. What else?
I mean, you know most of my cases, but I think they always see that light. They see that stability in someone, and they're seeking that person's stability.
That's right. You and your family, in a certain way, are going to give them an experience that maybe they didn't ever had. Or maybe they had, but not enough of. Maybe there's a happiness there. Maybe there's a stability that goes along with happiness that they see. They don't really understand it 100%, but they see there's something good about this, right? So there's something there, there's an experience. The rate of divorce that these kids have, that they're experiencing, is extremely high. Extremely high. Now, I'll tell you something about my school. I have a school that has very, I would say, academically upwardly mobile students, for the most part. They're very bright students. They're students who come from good places, you know. And I can tell you that in an average year, at least half of them, if not more, are coming from divorced homes. There's no question about it. Not to mention the fact that one parent might be Jewish and one parent isn't Jewish, or that there's assimilation. I mean, either you're dealing with divorce or you're dealing with assimilation. There's definitely stuff going on in the families, for the most part. When you get like a regular girl who comes from a conservative Jewish whole family, it's unique. It didn't used to be. It didn't used to be. And Rabbi Shurin, the rabbi that I worked together with, Rabbi Yitzhak Shurin, who's the Rosh Midrashah, he predicted this 10 years ago. He said, you're going to see that this brand of conservative Jewish, you know, whole family, it's going to disappear. And that's exactly what we're seeing right now in terms of who's coming.
That's coming across the country. I mean, the demographics are like that.
Sure.
It's over 50% of divorced.
That's right. So it just... So you're getting, that's right, so you're getting these kids, they step into your life, and they come for a meal, they come for an activity, and they see a couple that has a good marriage and a family, so you become a very critical role model for these people. You become very important to them. You're also sometimes put on a pedestal, right? And that can actually be a very dangerous place to be. I know, because I see this a lot with my students, you know what I mean? They come... And They see you at your best. They see you at your Shabbos table, right? Everything's set up so nicely. Everything looks so pretty, right? There's a lot of Torah talk at the table. They don't see how you were a few hours before, necessarily. And they don't see, and they put you on this place. And what happens when you fall? What happens when you say something that they don't like? Or that they don't... It's very scary. I always teach this to my students. A person is just a person. You know what I mean? You have to have a lot of respect, but you have to know, right? And you have to be careful as kiruv workers of this idea also. But you are a very important role model. And maybe these kids haven't been around children for a long time. Maybe they haven't seen it. Now finally they're seeing... seeing these things. So often what they're looking for, without even knowing it, is they're looking for stability, they're looking for family, they're looking for acceptance, and they're looking for happiness. So maybe you think they're looking for that lesson or that piece of Torah that you're going to teach, but I'm telling you that's not what they're looking for. They're looking for a lot of different things. And you're showing them how they can have that. See, it's funny because sometimes you think like there's a conversation that's so important that you have to have about a certain topic. But it's not the topic. It's the fact that you had the conversation with the person, that you took the time to spend with them, to be ma'arich them, to value them, that maybe they never got that or never got it enough, right? And you're modeling, they're watching you with your children. They're watching the answers you give. They're watching the time you spend and all of these kinds of things. So you become extremely representative. Sure. No, not at all.
You know, I'm thinking about what you said, and I'm also just thinking about something Rabbi Gottlieb was talking. Were you there yesterday?
Yes, yeah.
So he was talking about authenticity of self-revelation, revealing. Of course, he used examples like hiking and boating.
Right, that was a little
deeper than that, more unsafe than that, Alec. But I work with families, so I'm not working the demographic you're discussing. But self-revelation beyond mm-hmm. movies and hiking, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Being real, being honest with your own vulnerabilities. I mean, it's so interesting. My sister knows you, and uh-huh. I remember Sarah Schiff.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember Sarah. Her perception of you was like authenticity.
Aww.
So you're a role model, but your best, it almost seems like your best weapon, so to speak, is your authenticity. So what's that fine line between like genuine sharing of...
Well, I liked what Rabbi Gottlieb said. I liked what he said very much, that you shouldn't be afraid to share yourself.
Right, but there's too much sharing. Like where is it there on the other?
What does they say? TMI?
TMI.
Yeah. TMI. Too much information.
Right.
Yeah, so you got to be careful about that. Yeah, you know, there are certain things that are sacrosanct, you know.
Right.
I'm not going to tell them about certain things in my relationship with my husband. I'm not going to, you know... It's not their business. It doesn't really have a place. On the other hand, I'll tell them, for example, I deal a lot with the shidduch thing, you know, and dating. I'm dealing with girls at an age when they're very worried about, are they going to get married? Are they going to meet somebody? I don't care where they're from. They're all worried about that. No matter what group they're from or what hashkafa they're from, they're all worried about that. So I'll tell them things from my own life. I'll tell them. I won't be afraid to share. I also had a broken engagement. I'll tell them things like about how my husband wanted to dump me after the second date. And here I am married. You know what I mean? Like all kinds of things like that. I'll share with them. But I won't tell them the details that I feel are private. I'll be careful about that. I'll share other things with them, for example. And I always feel that honesty is the best policy. My youngest son, I have 5 sons, Baruch Hashem, no girls. That's why I have to run a girls' school. And my youngest son is autistic. He's 11, and after having 4 very, you know, capable, bright, you know, boys, suddenly I got this kid, and it was a major, major challenge in our family, and I went through it, you know, at the same time running Jesher Rachel. So I had to decide, how is it going to deal with this problem and deal with my students and help them and use it as a way to kind of like maybe make being from even better or even more modeling in this kinds of area. And what I decided to do is just be very upfront with it. Be very upfront with it, you know what I mean? And I get students sometimes who are in the field, who have training, and they'll tell me things and all sorts of things. And I'm like, I'm not different than them. In other words, like, I'm willing to talk about certain things, but will I tell them everything? Do I share with them the extent of the pain or the things that you have to go through? No. Because why do I have to put that on them? A, they don't need it. They don't want it. You know what I mean? But it's part of my life. So I'll use my life to be makar with people, but in a funny sort of a way.
I was there when he was born and through the first few years. And
yeah.
Like, we got it, do you know what I mean? I think it was very healthy that we were seeing what's going on, and we didn't need more than that, because we learned from how you were dealing with it, because we had small
bits of it. Right.
You know,
I took him to Shabbaton.
Cut up.
You know, like, all sorts of things like that. You're right. The authenticity is very important. Be real. Be with them. Share with them. Tell them things about your life. He's so right about that. He's so right, because who wants to be friendly with somebody who's like, doesn't do anything I do, or never did anything in their life that has anything connected to me? You know what I mean? On the other hand, sometimes it's shocking to me, because I really don't share certain things with their lives. You know what I mean? I really can't identify. I grew up from birth. I can't identify with the partying that existed in their lives in their college years. But I'm... That's what I mean. Like, now I'm coming into contact with that much more than I used to, and I have to deal with it.
Okay, but what if you can't
identify what?
With the party? Meaning that when you're, the self-revelation you're talking about mm-hmm. doesn't reflect negatively on you at all. But what if you were in their situation? What if you dealt with the darker, really difficult things
right.
that they're going through, and you also experience them? So you're not talking about, like, so for example, your issues with your autistic son are not, they don't reveal anything. They reveal your humanness, but
right.
not, they don't ship away.
Failure. That. It's not my failure. Hashem gave me this, and this is...
Yeah.
Right, I hear you.
But for them to see, she also partied, she also knows, like, she knows...
I can't say that, but I can do other areas.
So what do you do if you can?
Really? I can. That's what I said. That's why dating is a very big issue. I can. I had quite a history.
But is it inappropriate to reveal things about yourself that really are reflective of, like...
Failures.
Yeah. I guess that's the word. Yeah, like a...
Depends how. It depends how bad, and it depends what. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I made a mistake once. Or things like that. I went through a very hard time. I was very depressed. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And I couldn't even feel like I couldn't eat. Mm-hmm. There's other areas, you know what I'm saying? Like that a student is going through. We're going to go through some of the areas to talk about. You'll interrupt me and you'll ask me questions. But I started to talking about how modeling, how it works. So I just brought like a random note. I get these all the time from students, these kinds of notes where they write letters at the end. So this girl, Rev Dearlin, she was in school a couple of years ago, not long ago. I wanted to thank you, not necessarily for anything specific. Listen to the words. As I know, there are countless things you do that I am not even aware of. So if I just wanted to thank you for being who you are, that's what I'm trying to tell you. It's not so much the topics. It's not so much necessarily the specific classes. It's the modeling. It's who you are that's going to make a difference. Patience, avas yisrael, commitment. Commitment, that's what she's talking about. I'm grateful I had the opportunity to get to know you and your family. It goes together. You're a package deal. You know what I mean? It's not just about you. This year of learning will be a solid foundation for my marriage and my life as a Jewish wife and mother. You know? Then it was very cute. She gave me plants. And she wrote, I hope you like the plants. May you grow from strength to strength. You have this connection with the plants. Right? But the key to really understanding what to do with these students is to watch them, to observe them, to see who they are. Not just who I want them to be, but who they are. Who they are. And I think you have to have a lot of respect for your students. I'm not so sure sometimes if we get caught up in our agenda, you know, of what we want them to become. So we have this, like, you know, this mental checklist of who they are. But they also come with values. They also come with families and histories and a life and thinking abilities. And you have to respect that, because a lot of times it's very solid. Mm-hmm. If you think you're going to fix everything and you're going to remake them, I think that's a big mistake. Yeah.
I sometimes get stuck in the other place. I seem to resonate so much with people's situations. I almost feel bad for them to, like, change themselves. Because I know it's going to be hard for them.
Oh, like, you're emotional.
No, yeah, and I'm saying that do you know what I mean? Like,
Well, I have news for you. When you're dealing with, let's say, a 38-year-old woman who wants to become frum, and you know that if she becomes frum, her chances of shidduchim are going to be very, very difficult. It's a very tricky thing.
Right.
It's a very tricky thing, and you should be in consult with a rav about what to do. I'm not kidding. Because what will she do? You know what I'm saying? Like, it's very scary. You have to really speak to somebody very big to help you navigate that. Because you're right. Yeah, you're going to get into something.
I don't.
We had a student who recently, who was an older woman. Well, not older, but she was like in her 40s. And she met somebody. And this happens a lot of times. The guy wasn't frum. And she really is frum. She keeps Shabbos and Kashrus, and she believes in Torah and everything. But he's not frum. It would be very easy to say, dump him. Not me. I'm not going to tell her that. Do I want her to be alone the rest of her life? Do I want the achrayus of telling this woman that you're not going to meet anybody? Because the chances of her meeting somebody who's like her at that age are very slim. So I didn't say that. And we didn't say that in our school. We said to her, make sure that he's not negative. Is he open to you doing what you do? Is he supportive of you doing what you do? Make sure that he's not negative. But don't dump him. Whatever you do, don't dump him. You know what I mean? So you have to be observant of what their needs are, not what my needs are. My needs, of course I would love it. Of course the best thing is if she could meet somebody who'd be like her, and they could grow together, and they could have these marvelous Shabbos tables and invite all these guests over and be Miel de Ama, right? But if that's not happening, what am I leaving her with?
But hey, I think you were talking about when their lifestyle resonates.
Let's not their lifestyle, but who they are. Like,
she feels bad sometimes.
And I almost know, like, what she's like with certain things that if they
change.
If they, can I say a personal example?
Absolutely.
Right. So I love Laura's brother and sister-in-law. And I know that as they start keeping Shabbos more, they're going to have business issues. Like, so, like, their business is a Shabbos business.
What are we going to do?
And so, like, you know.
Okay, but that's, okay.
Well, no, I'm not saying Shabbos. I'm just saying, I totally get where they are now. I totally get, like, why he necessarily can't come to shul on Shabbos, because the business is open on Shabbos. Like.
Are you asking how you should feel or what you should do?
I guess the both.
Okay, so what you should feel is how you feel. Understand, you feel for the person with the entirety of what's going on for them, and that's legitimate, and that's how you should continue to feel. What you should do has a lot to do with halacha.
No, I'm not.
I'm saying, in terms of what you should do, in terms of their halachic things, is a different matter, and that you may have to operate at two different levels in your kirov work. Because on one hand, you have to be very sympathetic and very feeling. On the other hand, it's Shabbos.
Oh, for sure.
Right?
For sure. I'm just saying, but like...
The solution is done, and then someone buys the business for a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. For sure. I'm saying, but it's not with them. There's so many people that, like, I like, feel for where they are.
Good. You should. Why shouldn't you?
I think about it all the time.
I feel
like that sometimes gets in conflict with the agenda.
It shouldn't get in conflict. That's a very important point you brought up, because it shouldn't get in conflict. Because your agenda,
I don't.
Your
feel
real
like
agenda.
Like,
let me
I
tell you something.
Like
your real agenda is to be an Ohev Yisrael. That's your agenda.
That's what I'm saying.
Okay,
I feel like
hold on a second. To be an Ohev Yisrael, I think means to feel with people. To feel with people. You know, I have a student who, she comes from a family, the mother's not Jewish, and the father's Jewish. She became Jewish, she converted. And the parents came to our school last year for a meeting, and they're in constant conflict with the daughter, terrible conflict. So myself and Rabbi Shurin sat in, for about over an hour, we sat with these people. They're really liberal people. They're the type of people that were upset that their daughter didn't wear practically nothing to run in a marathon in San Francisco. Like, there's a certain marathon that I don't even know what it's called, but they run not dressed, or dressed in very little. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah,
okay.
They like run naked, literally.
Right. So she wore, she went in the marathon, she's a runner, she wore, like, a cute skirt, nothing, like, really super sneeze, just a regular skirt and a t-shirt. Basics. The parents were so upset at their crazy daughter. Can you imagine the olam hafuch, like how nuts this world is? The parents are upset that the daughter's not running naked in this marathon. So this is the type, okay? So they come to our office, and they have all these complaints against the daughter. And not only that, but the mother, who's really not Jewish, is very upset because the daughter won't come to Christmas anymore. Now Christmas, hold on, is a big family thing. For their family, for this family, this was their bonding time. This was very important for this family. Now, I could sit there, myself and Rabbi Sharon could sit there in absolute total judgment and look at these people like this, you know what I mean? And just give them a straight from me answer. But I stopped for a minute. I tried to put myself in this lady's shoes. I tried, you know what I mean? I said to myself, how would I feel if I was her and my daughter changed everything, changed all the rules of our family, what brings our family together, what we do for fun, what sports. She changed everything, and style was very important to this lady. So what she wore was like really important. And I just stopped for a minute and I said, you know, Mrs. So-and-so, I really understand how you feel. Because probably, and I said all these scenarios, this was very important, your family. And she goes, yeah. Mm-hmm. I said, I can imagine how hard it is for you that she doesn't do these things anymore. And she said, yeah. I said, well, I want you to know that we appreciate that. That we understand this. You know what I mean? This is not easy. And it's probably going to feel like it's very hard. I said, but you know what's really important in your family? What's really important is that you love each other. Not so much what you do or where you go, but that you love each other. You know what I mean? And your daughter loves you. She wants to be close to you. She loves you. But it's very hard because you're asking them to take like a 60-mile leap to step into this frum world, and it's so far.
Can you tell me if I did the wrong? Last summer there was a girl, she's in a very prestigious Ivy League college, she got a scholarship, and she's someone who came to our house a lot, and just a beautiful, meeting, mm-hmm. like a really special girl. And she went to Neve actually for the summer, mm-hmm. and here she has a scholarship, so obviously like she wasn't sure if she should stay, not stay, and she's very, like she has a, you know, a scholarship there. And she's going to lose the scholarship.
Oh, yeah. It's a hard one.
Right. So her father's calling me in a panic, like, you know, that she shouldn't lose her scholarship. And she's, like, totally conflicted. Her grandparents, of course, like, you know, the granddaughter's going to be the first doctor in the family. And I didn't tell her what to do. I couldn't say.
What did
know,
she
stay.
Do in the end?
She came back.
She came back.
She did come back. But I couldn't in all
honesty. How old was the girl? She was in the beginning of college?
Junior year, I think.
Sometimes you have situations like that.
I could, but
also,
was that
like, is it your role? I mean, like, we will go with, I know, like, in my community, it's the Torsis, Rosa Methel and Fady Torsis, who are probably the most pursued counselors in America.
Right.
And they do not tell you what to do.
I didn't tell her.
No, I'm just saying, I'm confirming that perhaps that's the right way.
It's not necessarily
the role. They never give you the bottom line what to do.
Sometimes you have to try.
Right.
Sometimes you have to tell, but sometimes you would say, it's my opinion.
Right.
But what I started out by saying is that you have to have respect for your students. You have to have respect for their minds, their ability to think right. through a problem. You can give them all of the pieces to put it together for them, to show them, if you do this, this is what the good effects of this is what the benefits are. If you do this, this is what will happen. These are some options for you. This girl who went back to Harvard or wherever she went, what I would have made sure to do...
Connect her with families.
Connect her, and also to stay connected with her.
No, so...
When you finish this program, you can come back. We'll make it easy for you to come back. Try to work. Sometimes you can't compete with a scholarship like that.
Back to this summer because
sometimes you can. I've had students who gave up very big amounts of money and scholarships and decided, that's it. I need to do this now.
But
they decided.
Right.
They decided.
You helped clear the road, but they had to make the alternative.
But that's the piece of respecting somebody's ability to use their bechira chavshes.
Yeah.
That's what Hashem gave us, and that's what we're supposed to utilize. We're supposed to help them understand what's on both sides.
But my point was, I wasn't even sure what the right thing for her necessarily was. I couldn't, in all honesty, I knew her family dynamic and that.
Very complicated.
I knew that the grandparents would be there.
Honestly, without knowing the girl or the story, it would be very hard for me to say what's right and what's wrong here, but you try the best you can. And you stay in touch with her. So, all right, I just wanted to move.
Sorry, I don't mean
to. No, that's okay. I wanted to just move on a little bit. In terms of some issues that we see, common things, there are many people. Many college students and older, and this comes, I didn't see it so much in the past, but I'm seeing it more and more now, that come with a lot of alcohol issues.
Really?
Yes, yeah. Drug and alcohol abuse is very much. How can you see that? If you're dealing with somebody, how are you going to know this? I'll tell you how you can know this, because I'll tell you how I see it sometimes. It's really amazing. Girls used to bring me, like Shabbos presents, often a bottle of wine. And in the old days, so sometimes we'd open the wine, everybody takes a little bit, nice wine, thank you very much. Half of it goes back into the kitchen at the end of the Shabbos meal. Not now. A girl might bring me a bottle of wine and proceed to pour herself the entire bottle. To the top. You know, I have wine glasses, but they're, you know, just there. I don't know, I just bring people to drink everything. 8 ounces. And then take some more. If you see that happening at your table, you should know that you might be, not necessarily, but you might be dealing with something more than you think. And I'll tell you a story. I mean, I'm friendly with Dr. Lisa Aiken, who actually has a very important book, which I wanted to show you all. It's called The Baal Tshuva Survival Guide. And in this book, she writes about a lot of different issues that you'll encounter with Baal Tshuva. She told me a story that happened to her that I felt was very worthwhile sharing with you. She said there were these two guys who were in a yeshiva. I'm not going to mention which one. One had been on drugs like years ago and had gone through a lot of therapy, and he was fine. One of them had been in alcohol and been through AA and was fine for 6 months. They went to their yeshiva, came to their rav's house for Shabbos, and their rav insisted that they have a l'chaim. Okay? They said, no, we don't want. Okay? The rabbi insisted. Okay, P.S. 6 months of sobriety went down the drain. The guy became addicted to alcohol again. The guy with the drug problems also began to have a problem, right? And the rabbi, in his sincerity, thought he was doing the right thing because he wasn't aware or observant of his population. Okay, there's a rule that doctors have. The first rule of medical school is do no harm. Okay, the first rule in Kiruv should be do no harm. Because you don't know who you're dealing with here. If somebody says to you, no, it's okay.
Absolutely.
Don't just think they're being polite. You better realize something. That coming from a culture, and the statistics are astounding, how much drinking is going on. Huge amounts. I had something very recently. It's a funny story. A girl wanted to come to our school, and she wanted to go into the dorm. And that particular dorm was having problems because they weren't, working enough keeping it clean, you know? And it was like some people were very upset. It was like one of these real dorm kind of issues. So I said to this girl who was coming and who wanted to come to the dorm, are you clean? She all of a sudden got terrified, and she says to me, since high school... I said, I meant, clean. You do the bathrooms. You know what I mean? I meant clean. And I saw, and I told her by Sharon this story. It was hysterical because there again, you suddenly, you open your eyes and you realize, hey, There's a lot more going on with these kids. They've been part of stuff that we don't really remember or think about too much, but that's a very big issue that you should be aware of in terms of a mental health issue. Don't become part of the problem. You should always offer an alternative at your table, at your Shabbos table. You should always have grape juice or one of these.
Martinelli's has apple juice cider.
Or something like that, or even those 5% wines. You know what I mean? Those kinds of things. Well, be careful, because the medical science says that anything more than 2 drinks a day is a problem. Let me just define for you what a drink is. A drink is 1 12-ounce can of beer, 1 4-ounce glass of wine, or 1.5 ounces of liquor or vodka or something like that. So anything more than 2 of those a day is a problem. It means the person, even if they can hold their liquor, their reflexes are affected, all sorts of things happen to them.
Because what are they doing to them? I always see where parents, people insist
drinking too much.
And given the culture of alcoholism,
right.
Has that changed a lot?
I see it all the time. I think it's very
it's been like these firm awareness things.
I think because this is what they're doing in college, people feel like when they come to my Shabbos table, I want to show you that I can relate, that I can be cool, that I could do it in a much different atmosphere.
Be careful though.
So it's
very complicated, and you have no idea what you could be tapping into there on a problem level. What do you do if you see it? Let's say you see somebody, you get like sense that there's kind of excessive drinking. So most likely the person who's doing that is definitely in denial. Okay, they're not going to admit it to you. But if speaking to them about it will alienate them, so then you don't want to do that, you're not going to do that. But what you should do if you see this problem and other problems is you should have in your repertoire connections with good therapists. You must have that. As a Kiruv worker, you must know that you are not mental health professionals. The biggest strength that you can have in your work is knowing when to refer. That's the first thing I did when I took my job. I decided to make a list and a study in Jerusalem of who to send people to. You know what I mean? So I have this one for this person thing and this one for that one, and I call them up regularly.
Do you want to go?
But you can only do it if you have a real kesher with the person. No, you can't do it if it's more casual.
But sometimes you need to make that kesher. If you see that problem, if not you, who?
Well, it's different for you probably.
You know what I'm saying? You see a girl that's doing something, right?
But for example, I have a girl who became a Facebook friend after one of our retreats. I would say 90% of her posts are this happy hour and this martini and this da-da-da. But I don't, and once in a while she'll open up a conversation and I'll open up a conversation. I don't have enough of a cash.
It's all Facebook.
Karen. Oh my God.
Facebook is not going to do it.
You know, but it's so belate. I mean, it's, you know,
You might want to send her to a website, have her look at some information about the problem, and let her do with it what she will. In other words, not ignore it. Send her something. Try to connect her in some way to something. Because otherwise it's just, it's continuing, right?
I know for me with NC's Y, what I've used my professional support sometimes is for the peers. Like, I had a girl that had to be institutionalized for bulimia, but I couldn't choose who she was going to, but I could choose who her friends were working with. And that made a big change.
Also, sometimes you ask the therapist yourself how you can deal with it. Like, you're not a professional mental health, but you say, I have this person, I don't feel that I'm close enough with them to tell them about you. What can I say to them to maybe get them to a point where they can realize it? Like, you as a mental health professional,
it's true, but
for yourself,
I've never, ever had a mental health professional tell me that you can do anything unless they are willing to do it themselves.
But if you never try to hook these people up and you ignore it, you become part of the problem. Just remember that. You become an enabler. You have to try to reach out. We've been talking a lot in this conference about arevas. This is survival. You know what I mean? We had a student once, and I hesitated before I agreed to do this whole thing, so I'm thinking to myself, boy, I talk about mental health issues, they're going to think my school is full of nuts. I really very normal, nice student. But nevertheless, if you're observant, you're going to see, because you're working with a population that comes from a culture that's full of this, so inevitably you're going to get this. You know, we had a girl who, you know, she was a great student. She came to school every day. She was serious, right? And one night I get a call that she was in the hospital, in Hadassah Hospital, with toxic alcohol. She had to be picked off the floor. And then I went into the dorm where she was living. And then I saw, stashed away, a bottle of vodka. And we have a rule, you're not allowed to have any liquor in the dorms or anything. So I say, where is this from? You know what she said to me? My parents bought it in duty free and gave it to me. It's coming down, okay? So then you get this. And you know, what are you going to do? So you got to try, you got to try to get her for help. You got to try to point her in the right direction, you know? Oh, for sure. It happens all the time. Go look in Israel at the seminaries. Go on Ben Yehuda Street. Full. Full with from birth kids who are drinking themselves into oblivion.
So, right. Do they usually go any further? I guess it's
in my cases, no. First of all, I'm working with a smaller population, and if I see it, so then they'll go because I have more. I'm on top of it. Right. But if you ignore it and there's nobody seeing it, nobody on top, they can go a whole 6 months without it. I have a problem right now that it's very hard for me to deal with. You see, certain things we all feel more comfortable to deal with and less comfortable to deal with. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So I've got one girl now, and I have very strong feelings that she might be anorexic. That's what I'm seeing. But I'm not 100% sure, but I'm pretty sure. From what knowing enough about this, mm-hmm. the sickness, I'm pretty sure. And I have to, like, I can't ignore it anymore. I can't ignore it anymore. She might just tell me, you know, go take a hike. You know what I mean? She might say that, and that then, you know, like I told you in the beginning, your students have bechira. At the end of the day, you have to respect the fact that they have free choice. But I, as a responsible Jewish person, have that arevus that I have to do something. Can't just let it go anymore.
And you pay for it too?
Oh, that's a good one.
Because there's some people that need referrals.
Let me tell you something. I worked very hard to create a therapy fund. Mm-hmm. And there were certain therapists that will work with me. Dr. Lisa Aiken actually is a very big help in this area because she is a very highly skilled therapist. She was a chief psychologist at Lenox Hill for 8 years. She's in a league by herself. And she will see my students for a greatly reduced rate. There are other therapists in Jerusalem the same that will do that. I have like an army of people that I work with. I have for certain cases, very rarely, but I have one guy who's a very top-notch psychiatrist. So sometimes I'll need that. Suddenly a student will come and she won't write on her application that she's bipolar.
Can you talk about
that? And then, you know, yet like... Wow, no, like what hit us, you know what I mean?
Can you talk, how do you deal with your bipolar students?
I hardly have bipolar students, but I have had a handful in my career.
And how do you deal with them?
I send them for help. I do not attempt to treat something like that myself.
Oh, no, for sure. But like,
oh, yeah, they have to go as they are going to be sent home. They have to go.
And you find that with the help they're able to integrate into school and like...
usually they're put on medicine. That's what happens. So it helps, but it's a hard road. Usually students like that, and this only happened once. Last year this happened in my whole career that I had this really... This girl came in. She wasn't even a student. She was just trying out the school. She wasn't accepted. She never wrote an application or anything. And I noticed there was something very strange about her affect and how she presented herself. And she would alternatively laugh and... her facial expressions and go like, you know, like really odd kind of things. And then she sat in some classes and then she would start to laugh inappropriately in the middle of class, you know what I mean? And the girls like didn't know how to relate to this girl, like it was really weird. So I said to her, after much discussion with Rabbi Shurin and the psychiatrist that I work with sometimes, that either you go for an evaluation or there's no chance that you're going to get into this school. No chance. She resisted it. It's also very hard to say to somebody right. or imply to somebody, I think you're a mental case. You have to go for a psychiatric evaluation before we take your application. That's not usual, right?
It's hard within the
So we sent her. She agreed.
Right.
The psychiatrist told me, I've never seen this, like, you know, you never sent me anybody like this. No, this girl has schizophrenia. This girl is definitely. So we told her, and we called the parent. This is not even a student of mine, understand? I could have just shown her the door. And I called the parent. The parent came to Israel. This was so crazy. And I couldn't let her into the school because I have to worry about my students, the rest of them. She wouldn't accept it. That she wouldn't accept the diagnosis whatsoever. The psychiatrist told her she can go to Hadassah and get an objective test that, you know, and she can say she liked the idea of a test.
Have noticed anything until...
Oh, I'm sure they did.
Okay.
I'm sure they did, but they were hoping that it would be otherwise.
Also didn't want to accept the day.
The mother, a little bit. It was just the mother involved. You know, really? She's so bad? Yeah. Now, you asked me about payments. So I said to the mother, before she did the evaluation, I said, it's going to cost you $250 to do this. It's a big evaluation. It's a big psychiatrist. So you have to pay for it. So wow. She agreed to pay for it. But I do have like a fund where I do try to help people who need therapy. But the fund can be exhausted very quickly. Very quickly. And it's a big problem. Because not just in Israel, it's a big problem because when you have people that are needy and you, as I said, must be aware, I'm not a mental health professional. I'm not trained to deal with bipolar, schizophrenia, or even alcoholism. Or even, we're going to talk about, like, depression, certain types of depression. So you got to know where to go. You got to get some help. You got to get resources.
But what if they don't accept it? At what point do you feel like you're not an enabler anymore?
If they don't accept it, and what do they want from you?
I guess the community, rabbinics, it's different. Like, everyone's invited to the shul. Like, you can't say you're not accepted if you don't.
That's how a person is acting, I suppose. You know what I mean?
No, but what's interesting with bipolar, or at least our experience, is that they go through like very on-from stages and off-from stages. And when they're on the on-from stage, like they want to be part of everything that's from and that's going on. And that's a little challenging if you've been through the whole bipolar cycle.
I think you have to try your best to get the person to help. There is no substitution for that. You will not fix it.
No, we're not.
No, but
no,
you won't. You won't.
Light. We're not.
You won't. You have to try to get that person to help. That's the best chesed you could do for that person.
And if they don't want, right.
You know, they don't want to.
Right. And then I can let go.
you never stop davening.
Right.
You never really let go, but you may have to let go in terms of what you can physically do.
Right.
If you live in an area where there are no front therapists.
First of all, you should talk to them. You should try to set up a meeting with them and talk to them about and ask them questions. What do they feel about, you know, certain topics that are important to us? How would they direct a student if she was, like, for example, let's say a couple is having a problem in their marriage, right? Is her starting point to just break it up, or is her starting point to try to work it through? What's her value system? You need to talk to these people. You need to set up a meeting and see where they're holding, what their general values are. How do they feel about Shabbos? Do they feel that Shabbos is the cause of all the problems? Yeah, because you're repressed and, you know, your religion tells you you can't do all these things. That's your problem. If you get rid of religion, you'll be fine. So, you know, you need to know. Even in, you know, I wouldn't parcel every not-from therapist. There are some very fine not-from therapists. And there are some people who need a lot of help. So don't parcel them, but talk to them. And see what their value system is and if you can work with them if you don't have anybody from. Not always is the firm therapist the best choice. You know what I mean? So just because they're firm doesn't make them the right answer. You know what I mean? I wanted to look at another issue that's pretty common, and no matter what your population is, and that is depression. Okay, that's a big one. The symptoms of depression, as you know, are sadness, crying, sleep disorders. Sometimes when a person wakes up very early in the morning, they can fall asleep, but they get up very early in the morning. They can't stay asleep. Weight gain or loss, sudden stuff like that. Sad, just, you know, mentions it a lot. Doesn't see a future. Somebody who sort of seems very hopeless. So when people see things like this, and when they are like this, it's always good, if you see this, to say to the person, to ask them, when they tell you how sad they are, ask them the following question. Have you ever thought of hurting yourself?
Well,
you wouldn't think to ask that necessarily. You might think to just discuss the sadness. Tell me about how you feel, right? No, no, no. You have to get something else, because what I'm getting at is that you need to see exactly how depressed this person is. Are they going in a direction where chas v'shalom suicide might be an issue? Okay. If they say yes, when you ask them, have you ever thought of hurting yourself? They say yes. So then ask them more. Ask them if they have a plan. Like as if it's normal. Don't judge them. Don't say, that's bad. Wow, really? You know what I mean? Or try to save them in a second, because you won't. Ask them if they have a plan. The more detailed a person is in terms of answering you on these questions, the more urgent it is that you get them help immediately. Okay? Because it's a big unknown.
But do people get offended if you say, like, did you ever think of hurting yourself?
Who cares? Okay. And is that like, you can't worry about that?
Right, because some people are just sad sometimes, and they want to talk about
it. So who cares? Right. If they get offended, you'll just say, oh, you know, I just was concerned about you. You know what I mean? I want to make sure that you're always safe.
Well, you're not worried about them being offended because you need them to like you. You're worried about them being offended because you don't want them to retreat from you. That's where it's...
But usually they don't. People who are in disposition, I mean from a mental health perspective, that's not the reaction. They actually will tell you. They actually will tell you, and usually they'll tell you because they really, it's a cry for help. So it's different than how you think it might be.
Can you go to like the less extreme examples? Because I see a lot of people who are not, let's call them personally depressed. I wouldn't call them like anxious, or maybe.
Regular neurotics.
Just regular. Just talking about well-being. Yeah. Instead of like real hardcore examples of mental health, but in overall, what's the word? Like light.
You should know something. It is extremely common. This is another thing that we never used to see, and we see now on applications. We have a question that says, are you or have you ever been treated for emotional illness or whatever? Or have you ever been on medication? Now, we expect people to answer that question honestly. If they answer honestly, even if they say yes and they write us the name of the medicine, we'll still take them if they're doing well and they're normal people. Because if you don't, you're ruling out literally over half the population. Okay, I'm just telling you, literally half the population is on Prozac. There's no question about it, or like drugs. Okay, that's not bad. It's when they...
50%?
I'm telling you, it's enormous.
Wow.
It's enormous.
I knew it was high, but I didn't realize it was
enormous.
High.
And if they're not, they should be.
But that means they're being treated.
That means it.
But so then they should be. I have two girls I'm working with. I've been working with for a year. We've been working together, whatever. And they're both like just constantly like this sad kind of like neurotic.
Yeah, like,
so I was saying to her husband, I was like, I think they're depressed. Like I really like it's hard to talk to them. Like I can't ever have them together because it's just awful. I tried and it was like a black hole of despair. So I just discovered this past Sabbath that they're both on medication. They're both and they've been treated for years. Both of them have, one of them was diagnosed in high school and the other in college, and they're both like 28, 29.
It's very hard.
And like, so my question is like strategies to deal with them. Mm-hmm. One of them is I can't have them together as I learned this Sabbath.
That's smart.
But they're both, I would have never, I mean like I just thought they were depressed, but they're both being treated and they're both, one of them was very open about it. She's like, you know, I'm working on my medications to try to adjust and how to do it or whatever. And, but yeah, strategies to deal
with that. The first thing that I can tell you is don't be quick to give advice. Okay, we come from a culture where we think that if we talk it out and we give them advice, we can fix it. You can't always fix it. A lot of times with a depressed person, they need you to listen to them and not to tell them what to do. So you have to have a switch your mind gear, like what is my goal with this person right now? Is my goal here to change this problem and fix it and I'm going to be able to do it? Or is my goal, you know, this person has a problem, and in your case, it's a known problem. What is my goal here? They're under treatment. They're on medication. My goal is, I would say in your case, is to listen to them and support them.
That's
and to see. See, not all cases, if they they're not always getting help. See, so you have to see if they're open to getting help. So I would say something like this to a girl that I suspected of being clinically depressed or in that direction. I would say, I think you deserve an opportunity to speak with someone who can understand what you are going through. Because that validates them. I'm not judging them like there's something wrong with you. I'm telling you, you're a person of worth. I think you deserve an opportunity. You're already a special person. You deserve an opportunity to speak with someone who can understand what you're going through. I'm saying that I agree that what you're going through is very hard. I'm not judging what you're going through, right? So by saying this way, you're validating their feelings. You're putting the subject of getting help in a very positive kind of way. Now, let's just look at what are the triggers of depression. What can you know? Like, look in your communities or in your schools or wherever. One is somebody who's socially isolated. If you have somebody who's alone, an older person or even a younger person, college student, they're socially isolated, that person is at high risk for becoming depressed. Stress is at home. Stress is in a marriage, right?
Is social isolation the trigger?
It's a trigger. No, it's a trigger. It can make somebody fit. It doesn't necessarily mean...
You're saying because they don't have a...
Right.
I thought you...
These are triggers of depression that in your work you should be looking for, because if you see a person who has these things, then you should know, be on the lookout, this person might be depressed and might need help. One is social isolation. One is stress at home. Another one is breakups that go on. Either they broke up with a boyfriend or even in their parents, you know, their families. There's a divorce coming up. There's different things going on. Parental problems, things that you hear about through the family, you know what I mean? Difficulties in the family. Separating from parents. A lot of times I see this in my school, that a girl really believes it's the right thing that she's coming from and everything, and she knows this is the lifestyle. But separating from her family is extremely depressing, inducing.
Yeah,
it's very hard.
So funny, isn't becoming from often like a trigger for them? Because it's like they're...
That's what I'm saying.
Like,
separate from your family, but even separate from the family. Taking on all these new things can trigger a lot of... No?
My experience has not been that produces depression. It's sometimes overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
It's a feeling of being overwhelmed and scared.
Uh-huh.
And not so much depression.
Right.
Depression I see coming when they feel like they're losing their families.
Uh-huh.
They're losing... So where am I left?
Right.
I'm losing my family. You know, I have a girl right now. I can't get her to go to therapy. I wish I could. Her mother... does not talk to her since she became from.
Really?
No.
I thought people were like, parents were more accepting now of, you don't find more with the American culture of, you know, you do your
do what you want?
Yeah.
Sometimes. You know what she told me? My mother would rather I be a lesbian.
Definitely. Well, that's much more socially acceptable, but like...
My mother-in-law told us, my mother-in-law said straight out 5 years ago, I'd much rather my son became a drug addict. I know how to deal with that problem. I know how to fix it. She's like, I don't know how to fix it. It took us 5 years to get past her
telling such a pain,
your husband,
that's such a painful thing for your husband to hear.
Very painful. We're 5 years later, he's still trying to like repair the relationship with his
such a painful thing.
She said,
to hear.
I can fix that problem. Because she saw it as a problem that needs to be fixed. And that's not socially acceptable to be a drug addict.
But this girl that I have, her mother doesn't talk to her. There's no contact. She refuses to talk to her.
Was the relationship really good before?
No, I'm sure there were problems before. There's undoubtedly, when something like that happens, undoubtedly there's problems. But you should know, when you hear that in your office or in your home, somebody tells you that,
right, it's a trigger.
It's not just the conversation topic. Mm-hmm. It means that person is dealing with something that maybe is going to lead to something that they can't deal with alone. So what helps them? Support, listening, giving them an opportunity to get further help. That's what your function should be when you see that happening. And if the person doesn't have money, then it's your job to raise the money. That is the biggest form of tzedakah. That's what you have to do.
Some people, like I know in Jacksonville, the JFCS, Jewish Family Services, whatever, they're very, open to working with people and then reduce rates. So I don't know what community you live in, if they have something like that.
If you find that the person is very resistant, try to figure out why.
So most of the time, it's because they know they need help, but they're not ready to go down that road because they don't want to confront much, even more pain to get there. Like, in other
words, they don't
want
to do
it
the work.
Is so painful.
So then you say
that this is manageable, and that is not.
Okay, so
that's
what you have to work on.
Right.
You're going to have to talk to her exactly about that. There's a student that I have that she won't go for help. And she blames Hashem for everything. She blames Hashem for her situation. She says to me, I did so much to be religious. Mm-hmm. I quit my job. I endured anti-Semitism. I dealt with, familial...
discord.
Yeah, discord. She's very angry.
And then why is she...
She's very angry.
What does she look at in her
So, life? And I say that she's also not married. And this girl, there's no way, in my opinion, unless Hashem makes an outright miracle for her, there is no way that she's going to be able to get married in this mental state. Because that anger, it's like in waves, it comes at you. Sit down with her in an office, and she's really a nice girl, you should know. She has good values. She did good things in her life. But this anger, unless it gets dealt with, anger and depression are just flip sides, by the way. They're very related. I'm just telling you right now that if you see somebody who's very angry, chances are they're very depressed. And if you see somebody very depressed, chances are deep down, they are very angry about something. This case, this girl, she's angry about her life situation. She's angry at God for not fixing it. She's angry at her parents. She's angry at the world. Now, I have been trying for months, and I have a pretty good track record of getting people into therapy. And this girl, I cannot get her therapy. So my goal is to try to help her understand why she's so resistant. Not to fix it, just to label it so that we can get her to move to the next step. I got to do that for her. Because if she leaves my school without recognizing that, it's true she's keeping Shabbos better. It's true that she knows more material. But it's not going to help her in her life, really. So she's going to be stuck.
On that note, do you see that the recidivism rate is higher with the girls who don't get help, that they can't sustain where they are in terms of Shabbos?
I never did a study on this, so I can't tell you any, conclusive things, but I think it would make sense to say that somebody who's dealing with some bigger issues and hasn't resolved them, when the religion stops working for them, will give it up. Because it's not making their life. It's not really the issues for them. You understand? They've got to really fix... Sometimes people become religious because they think that's what's going to fix these other problems. But it's not about that. I have a girl who came to my school this year. She seemed to think the reason she was coming to the school was because she had issues in oral law. Okay? That's the presenting issue. That's what she told me when I recruited her on campus. Okay? When she got to Israel, and we actually spoke to her, and we realized what's going on with this girl, those weren't her issues. She had many personal issues. And holding on to these other religious, quote-unquote religious problems, was a way to avoid dealing with her life. So we got her some help. You know what I'm saying? It's like, you have to, that's what I said at the beginning. You have to be extremely observant and extremely analytical. You have to have a lot of respect for your students to know that they have a brain and they've been thinking about certain things for a long time, you know what I mean? And you have to figure it out. It's a puzzle.
In, for example, non-clinical mental health, in other words, they don't need medication. They're just having issues. They're anxious. They're not having a great relationship with their husband. Have you found in your experience that... let's say, not giving them specific advice, but doing, let's say, learning with them, let's say, Musa, or self-improvement, teaching them about our
helps.
Values, helps them work it out for themselves.
Definitely.
So you're saying that...
they take ideas.
Number one, your step is to make sure that they're not clinical, but and maybe not give them necessarily tell them what to do, but that we do have the ability, and that we should...
Yeah, for sure. Torah is a very big thing.
You can't decide if they're clinical or not. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I deal... one person came to me and told me how anxious she was, and she said, what should I do so that I don't sleep at night? I'm worried my husband's going to be killed. I'm worried I keep thinking about the windows being broken. Somebody's going to come into my house. I'm like, I'm thinking about this. And it's waking me up at night. I'm like, so I don't want to tell her right away. And so
Who's regular? Yeah, they don't advertise.
You can't walk around thinking that every single person that you meet,
you know, like do a checklist, but you don't need to see a therapist first before you teach them anything. Tell them. So say, try this strategy. Right. This is a strategy. Mm-hmm. And also there are other strategies that can work in concert with this. So sometimes seeing a therapist or sometimes getting some chemical balancing can help the strategy work better.
Right. Sometimes I'll do a session with a student. I do have a little training in counseling myself, but I'll sit with a girl and we'll have a very good conversation, and she'll feel better because she's revealed certain things about certain issues. And I'll say to her like this: I bet you feel better now that you spoke about this. She goes, yeah. So I say to her, you know why? Because in this conversation we looked at this and this and this, and that's important for you. And I really think that if you spoke to somebody professional, you could do much more of that. Because I can only take you so far. That's not my role. It's not my role in the school to do that. And I don't want to do that. You know what I mean? And I'm not trained enough to do that. But I just started out a little bit. And sometimes that's what helps them to go on with it. And, you know, that's a very big thing, a very big chesed that you can do. I think, like I said, you have to really have a lot of Avas Yisrael to do this job. You have to care enough if you really love somebody. So then your first response is going to be with that person. We spoke a little bit about the issues that students have with their parents and the alienation that goes on and the issues of Kibbutz Avanim. So I teach in my school a course, Bein Adam L'Chavero, and one of the topics that I teach is Kibbutz Avanim. Very important topic. But I'm very humble teaching that topic because I don't have the same challenges that my students have. I'm teaching them they have to be Mechavi their parents, right? Parents who don't want them to keep Shabbos. Parents who don't want them necessarily to keep kosher, who are angry at every turn of the way, all these decisions that they make. And I'm going to preach to them about that, how they should do Kibbutz Avanim. Like, I tell them this. I really take a back seat to you. These things were not challenges in my life, right? I had parents who kept Shabbos. I had all these things. But you have to work with your parents. I try to tell them, your parents gave you a foundation and they loved you and you are who you are because of these people, and you don't throw them in the garbage because you became religious. If somebody walks out of my school being less respectful to their parents, I consider it a failure. We consider it a failure. Our job as religious educators is to help them to work with what they have in a healthy way. So when your mother or your father is really upset about the things that you're doing, right, to the point where it's like very, very difficult, address their feelings. You don't have to agree with them, but you have to address where they're at. Ma, you're so upset, I can see how much pain you're in. I didn't say anything that I agreed. I didn't say anything that I disagreed. All I did was say, you are in so much pain from this, aren't you? I'm making it very hard, aren't I? Yeah, you are. Why can't you be different? I wish I could. Understand? I wish I could fix this pain for you. I wish I could. I chose because you gave me the skills to make independent choices. You gave me those skills. I chose this and this, and I owe it to you that I had the strength to make these choices because of you. But I understand how hard it is for you, and I want you to know that I'm not pulling the rug out from under us. I intend to come home. I intend to have family things. I intend to be there. My kids will spend time with you. You have no idea what the fear is, you know what I mean, on the part of these people, and how much it affects these kids, how like hard it is for them, you know what I mean, and what they have to sacrifice. It's very complex, right? So that's another thing I want to talk about. Hold on a second. Yes, another issue that's very critical is people's self-esteem. Self-esteem issues is like major. So you have to see this. If you're dealing with a person who has very low self-esteem, everything in their life is going to be hard for them. They're going to have problems at every turn of the way. You know what I mean? And you're going to know that you have to try to build them for them. You have to try to help build their self-esteem. You have to be there for them 100% of the way. And you have to try to get them help if you can. You can't just make somebody prune and walk away. You have to be there for them 100% of the way. You know what I mean? And there are times when that's going to be a very difficult piece for you, because you wake up one day and you say, no, I don't have time for you today. I want to go with my family, or I want to go do my life, or I want to do this. Right? But it's like, who was it that was saying that? Maybe it was Rabbi Gottlieb or Rabbi Edelstein said something like, you had a plan, you were going to daven and you were going to do all your... Who was that?
Rabbi Gottlieb.
You were going to do this, and then this person calls you up and takes all the time, and you're left with 5 minutes to daven, right? And he said, don't worry, you didn't lose. I feel like this happens to me all the time, that, you know, that I was going to do something and I had a plan, and then suddenly a student will call up with a problem. And there went my whole free time.
What about your children's needs? Balancing
those. Yeah.
Nothing. It's like if you think
I know it's very hard, and I have to tell you something. I think that there is a sacrifice. Anybody who tells you that everything can be 100% on all fronts is lying. Okay, it's not true. I think there were times when my family sacrificed for the cloud. There's no question about it. And there were times when I probably didn't do what I should do with my students, because I did for my kids, you know, when I said enough. But there were definitely times when I was very, very super involved with students and I just wasn't there all the time. I have to say that. But part of this is that you're taking people that don't have the families. You're reparenting a lot. You know what I mean? And to reparent means that you have to reparent. So I can't only do this when it's convenient for me. I can't only do it when it's convenient for me. I'm gonna leave this person, like, you know, half done. You know, one of the nice things on my trips, right now I'm on a trip for my school, and a lot of it is alumni development, coming and seeing the alumni and doing like events. So I did an event in New Jersey last week. And about 25, 30 students came to the event. And from all different years, from all different places, and seeing them, you know, and remembering all their issues and all the time that they spent and talking to them, and then they connect with that, you know, like, you become a link for them in the same way that their families are. You become like a very important link in their life, in their mental health, in their development as Jewish people. You are very important for them, because they don't have that elsewhere. They don't have that, you know? Now, I wanted to just do one other thing. How much time do we have? Very little.
I think
we're technically... Oh, no. Okay. There's something I wanted to do with you. Just a little thing. Yes. I gave you out a sheet, right? Whole bunch of mafarshim on it, okay? So I did a class on Hashavas Aveda. All right, Hashavas Aveda, as everybody knows, is returning lost objects, seemingly, right? And then I came across an Or HaChaim that turns the mitzvah upside down. And I'm not going to go into the text, you can do that at some point, but he reads the mitzvah the following way. If you look at the psukim on the top, it says, Lo tireh et shor achicha o atzion nidachim v'talamta mehem, hashev tishibem l'achicha. He said, you shall not see the shor, the ox of your brother, or the sheep, cast off and hide yourself from them. You shall surely return them to your brother. V'im lo karov achicha lecha, and if your brother is not close to you, v'lo yidato, and maybe you don't even know him, you don't even know who he is. You shall gather him into your house, until you should gather him to your house, and he will be with you until your brother comes and will return to him. V'chein ta'aseh l'chamaro, and so you shall do to his donkey, v'chein ta'aseh l'simlato, and his clothes, v'chein ta'aseh l'chala v'edat achicha, and to all of the lost things or the objects of your brother, asher tovad, mimenu umatzata, lo tuchal hitalem. And you are not allowed, again, a reminder, to turn a blind eye. So the Or HaChaim reads this, not about things. The Or HaChaim says that, he said, these psukim is tochacha to the righteous people of Am Yisrael, who are called the brothers of God. Okay? Hashem sometimes refers to himself in different terminology, and one of the terminology is that he's a brother. Okay? So, if you read that in this way, who are the shor and who is the seo? Who are the oxen and who are the sheep? The Or HaChaim HaKadosh says that's referring to Am Yisrael. And we are called sometimes sheep, you know that. Son Yisrael, we're called a lot of times. These terms are terms that are referenced to the regular people. So he says, if you see, you, the righteous people, see the regular people, right? Cast off, nidachim, meaning they get involved in the cultures of the day. They are not part of you anymore. They are disconnected. This is the Or HaChaim speaking. You cannot ignore that. What does he say you have to do? You have to return them le'achicha. Who is achicha here? Hashem. You have to return them to Hashem. And what if he's not close to you? And what if you don't even know who he is? Doesn't matter. He says you have to gather them in into your house. What's your house, the Or HaChaim says? The Beit Midrash. You must bring them to a Makom Torah. You must bring them to the house of Torah. And then they will be with you until HaKadosh Baruch Hu will reconnect with them and will return to them. And this is what you have to do with everything that's lost. Every aspect of the person. Yeah, the chamor, the simla, these are aspects of the person. Every aspect of the person that's lost, you must try to bring it back. You. So look how the Or HaChaim reads this mitzvah. This is a mitzvah of kiruv. This is a mitzvah, not of. Of objects. This is a mitzvah of souls. That's how he sees it. And down there, and I quoted for you also the Taurus Moshe, which is the Chassam Sofer. He also says this. I'll just quickly read it. Lo tere asher achicha watzio nidachim yomar shelo yireh beinecha chas v'shalom shenishmat achicha nidachim. Never think of the soul of your brother as something cast off. Not worthy. Never think of him as not worthy, right? And turn away from him. Chalila. Ella, afilu imlo karova chicha elecha, velo yedato. Even if your brother is not near you, he's not close to you, and you don't even know him. Peirush shehu betachlis harichot mikol makom, vavios al toch beisecha. In any event, no matter where he's up to, bring him into your house. Kamosha asa Rav Yochanan l'Reish Lakish v'Hillel l'Hai Giora. And the way that you all know the famous story, right? Rav Yochanan l'Reish Lakish. Reish Lakish was a robber. He was a ganav. He was, you know, not doing too well in his life. And Rav Yochanan brought him in, and he made him close to him. Right? He actually married his sister. And then we know the story of Hillel and the famous scare, right? Teach me the Torah while I stand on one foot, right? So it was legitimate of Shammai to say, like, what kind of a disgusting thing? Are you making fun of me? Teach me the whole Torah while I stand on one foot? Of course he's, you know, get out of here, right? But it's not what Hillel did. He took a person whose attitude needed a lot of correcting and a lot of work, and he brought him closer. And here the Chassam Sofer says the same thing. This is what this mitzvah is about. Take the people who you think are very far from you, who don't connect to you, right? And you have to take these examples. You have to do it. Rabbeinu Bechai, I'll just end with this. He also says a very interesting thing on this mitzvah. He says, Aval derech ha-midrash v'talamta mehem ibnei adam lo tuchal. You can hide yourself from people. Lo tuchal hitalei me'kadosh baruch hu. But know one thing. You can never hide from Hashem. He knows everything. Ve'im taskil od b'mitzvat hashavat aveda. And if you like further look into this mitzvah, timtza ki yesh ba remez v'hitorut l'inyan triyat hametim. Very beautiful idea that he said this mitzvah is giving us a hint to the concept of the resuscitation of the dead. Shekadosh Baruch Hu machzir aveda leba'alav b'acharit hayamim. That God Himself will return a lost thing to the owners in the end of days. He's also going to do this mitzvah. Right? So this is the mitzvah that we're all involved in. When we're talking about somebody's mental health, we also have to return a lost thing to a person. Okay? A person's well-being, a person's sense of self, a person's sense of esteem. These are things that belong to every person. This is your birthright. And you, as the Kiruv person or a person involved in somebody's life, even not in Kiruv, just a regular person in your family or something, have that responsibility to bring them back to wellness, to wholeness, to feeling good about themselves. There is mamash no greater gift that you can give somebody. Okay?
Thank you very much.